Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference, or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to Eli Ritter, and if I'm talking to Eli, then you know it's time for another Guelph Stuff. In case you've forgotten, Guelph Stuff is a monthly-ish edition of the podcast where I sit down with Guelph Politico contributor Eli Ritter, and we talk about, you know, Guelph Stuff. It's a venue for some light punditry on local issues, with two guys working the local political beat, and it's that time again to offer some analysis on local news from the last month. Guelph Stuff is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast. Now, since we last gathered for a Guelph Stuff segment, there's been a lot of stuff that's happened in the council chambers. It's been a very busy first month of 2019, and along with the usual business of council, there were some pretty big final decisions that councillors were being asked to make. So on this edition of Guelph Stuff, we're going to talk about the big decisions. First up, the decision on the Parkland Dedication Bylaw and the update of the Development Charges Bylaw. Several delegates came out to speak to this one or both of the topics, which have a direct impact on the cost of development here in Guelph. Council had to walk a fine line, but did they make the right decision, and what do we make of the community reaction? And after that, we discussed the Guelph Transit Service Review, which came back with a dozen recommendations that, for the most part, weren't terribly surprising. So what didn't surprise us about the service review of public transit, and what lessons can we take away from one city councillor's attempt to take transit for a week? And then finally, we'll wrap things up with a chat about an issue that's both local and provincial, the announced changes to OSAP and student fees, along with the proposed cuts to tuition. Since Eli is both a student and a journalist, he provides a unique perspective on this topic, and I think you may hear that we come to some interesting conclusions, or at least we dig down into some more interesting questions. So I caught up with Eli Ritter earlier this week in studio. Hello again, Eli.
Hello.
It's good to be back for a Guelph Stuff a bit. We're going to go for monthly, but we're a bit late. It's been a busy month. So we're going to try and talk about some of the Guelph stuff. And we're going to talk about we're going to talk about a couple of things, but one of the meetings in particular, you took point on doing the live tweeting for the development charges.
Yep.
Let's do a little employer employee feedback here.
Uh-oh.
And like how did you enjoy it?
Well, it was nice to sit at the press booth. I was wondering when someone was going to ask for my ID or something like that.
Nobody asked for ID.
But people there knew me, I guess, somehow, so that's nice.
You ran for city council months ago.
Well, there was a lot of people. Hey, think of it. There was like 60 candidates across the city. So
fair enough.
But, I mean, that was nice of them. And no one kicked me out, so that was great. The one thing I was worried about is if I was stealing someone's seat. Like if Tony Saxon, if that was like his
there's
seat.
There's assigned seating?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I hear you. There's no assigned seating.
Just good.
First come, first served.
I was scared there for a moment.
I don't think CBC ever worries about stealing a seat when they come in.
Oh. But, well.
When they come in. But I mean that's the interesting thing. Just to talk about media for a second, Guelph, because, you know, it's always a topic of conversation. It's, you know, do we have enough media, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, you can start, you, the listener, could start, like, Guelph Post or something. No, you're Guelph Post. Guelph Gazette.
Yeah.
And then, you know, come to council meetings and sit there and sit at the press booth. One of the things I'm advocating for is, like, a press club at City Hall. Like, just like a room where, you know, press can
official
hang out.
Official press.
Yes, exactly. And maybe that would require some kind of press pass, as you were alluding to.
Like Queen's Park.
Yeah.
I've been in there once.
Oh, so have I, yeah.
Yeah. Just for the Bill 66 thing.
Oh, yeah.
Or, no, 178. The one that brought, that ended the college strike.
Oh,
I did
for the
Avro Post, like for the student newspaper. And I had to get, like, not approved, but they had to look me over. And
yeah, yeah. They have to make sure you, I don't know, look like press.
Yeah. I had the side bag.
I found the process pretty easy.
Yeah.
It's,
I forget.
It's still pretty Yeah, I mean, it's as long as, you know, you've been in touch with the press office and they know they're expecting you and they just check you out, make sure you're, you know, you show them your ID and you're legit and away you go. It's pretty good for a day visit.
Bam.
But anyway, yeah, something like that. Like, my idea for a press club is just like a nice room with like a couch and like maybe some vending machines in it for that when, you know, meetings go past 11 o'clock at night.
That's true.
Because that's the most frustrating thing is like when you don't bring a lunch with you, like yeah. You're not anticipating like having to have a lunch in the middle of a 7-hour meeting. It's nice to go to a vending machine.
It goes on forever. It would be cool to distinguish like who's the press and who's like maybe a few bloggers or something like that. It's just because you do work for it and it's
well,
it's good.
No, people. Okay. The difference, I think, is if you're at City Hall, you're press. That's because that's an actual reporting function.
That's true. Okay. That's fair.
But if you're like at home and you're just reading the Guelph Today article or you're going through the Guelph Politico live moment.
That's the one you should go to, guelphpolitico.ca.
Well done. All right. We're
but it was a good experience. It was good.
Good.
I used TweetDeck, which I know is the one that all the pros use, and I liked it, and it was good, and I didn't know how to make a moment, but Adam had me covered, so... Good.
All right. That's enough shining light into our operation.
Yep.
But the development charges meeting, this was maybe a surprisingly big deal. How many speakers do you recall? It was over 20, right?
Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. And then, so there was the delegates, and then there were people that stayed on afterwards, and I forget what they were officially known as, but the people that... like advisors or something like that. And there were a few of the delegates, and that included the vice president from U of G and a couple of other ones, including Susan Watson, I believe, too.
Yeah.
I don't know what they were officially called, but they also stayed on beyond just their delegation.
Right. They're, you know, they delegated and then sat in the gallery.
Oh, okay.
So were they part of a group?
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but now I'm just confusing everyone, but yeah.
But no, it was a pretty big deal, which is unusual because I think development charges, that's pretty far in the weeds in terms of the functioning of city council.
Right.
So can you explain about... You know, from your recollections and your coverage about what happened that night and what everybody was concerned about?
It was a bit ago, but I remember that one of the significant things that the mayor pointed out is that they worked in collaboration with staff prior to the meeting to sort most of it out so that it was kind of smooth going from the start of the meeting. And so there wasn't too many surprises, I guess, for the counselors. Everyone was kind of asking a few questions, and there was a couple particular different topics that were focused on. One of them was the when you add on to your house and whether that addition is being used for housing or not being used for housing and how the development charges would apply to that. Mm-hmm. So, and there's a specific word for that. I think it's called non-residential and residential housing, and how they were adding on to the housing and what development charges would apply to that.
Right.
So that was one of the bigger issues that came up.
Yeah, there was the same thing with parkland, actually. It's almost the exact same thing where if you're putting an addition on your house, does that count as having to pay parkland dedication fees? And I guess the hair that was split was if you were building, like, let's say you have a piece of property and you're tearing down the original residence and are building two residences, which sometimes happens, then that would count as an increase to the number of people occupying that land. Ergo, you would have to pay parkland fees. But if you're just putting on an extra, like renovating an accessory apartment or, you know, cleaning up your basement or whatever, then that doesn't apply.
It's different,
yeah.
And I think, so the big idea with parkland dedication, correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. is that you have commercial properties or even residential properties, and the developer will buy land and build something on it, but in turn they have to do cash in lieu or create a parkland area.
Right. that if you space. Yeah, if you buy a piece of land, if you're going to build like townhouses or something, or even just a house, that yeah, then you either dedicate a portion of that land to a park or you pay cash in lieu. Now, if you're just building like a house, it's like a tract of land, and you're building a house, you're obviously not going to give up like 3 square inches for parkland or something.
Yeah.
So that would be an instance of cash in lieu. Or if something like an apartment building, and you have like a very thin, narrow tract of land, and you're building, you know, a 5-story apartment building, you might do cash in lieu for that as well. But I think city staff, I believe this is almost a direct quote from city staff, is that they would rather have the land than having a big pot of money to buy land.
And I know one of the issues that came up last election, it was kind of a little bit off the radar, but was this idea that too many companies were given cash in lieu and not doing the parkland dedication. And that was one of the issues popping up, is that we were having a lot of the buildings, but not a lot of the parkland.
Right.
And I believe, now you probably know more about this than I do, but I think some changes were moving forward with that and how that worked.
Right. It was also... I mean, one of the base concerns too was that the bylaw hadn't been updated in 30 years.
Yeah.
So the numbers were all askew. So and there was really no sort of idea on how to manage like high rise development. So we have buildings in the city that are going up that are like 6, 8, 10, 14 stories.
Huge.
So you're
Yeah.
But that, you know, so you're talking about hundreds of people moving into a building. Maybe not that many, but you know, let's say dozens of people moving into a building.
Yeah.
You have development going up all over the place. And as you said, it seems like cash in lieu is becoming more and more the default. Rather than setting aside the land, it's like, well, we want to maximize the land. We want to maximize profits by putting as many people into this thing as possible. So we don't want to give up. Even if we have a sizable piece of land, we don't want to give that up for a park. So, yeah, it was a twin terror of, you know, the thing being heinously out of date, and the city also quite, as many people have pointed out, being rather behind in the parkland that's being developed.
Right.
Yeah. So it's the parkland thing is it's interesting that the two things came up at like relatively the same time. They're different, but they do also sort of feed into each other.
All part of the budget process, I guess.
Yeah, it's part of the budget process, and it's also part of the development process, and it's part of the greater community concern about, you know, building too fast and not really putting too much thought beyond the impact of one specific development at a time, and you know, ending up heinously behind in, you know, what green space is available and where we put that green space.
Right, and how many extra meetings have there been beyond normal council meetings this month? Like January, February, leading up to the March approval of the last budget? Because there's 4 budgets, and there's been several extra meetings?
Yes, there was. 5? Yeah, there was. It's interesting because there was the Committee of the Whole. There was 4 budget meetings, plus a regular council meeting. That was also a combination planning meeting. There was the DC meeting. And there was the transit service review meeting.
Right.
So it's about 10 meetings, I would say. In 1 month period, which is I don't think that's super unusual. I've certainly seen that many meetings packed into a month before. But it is sort of super unusual in that we're coming right off. We're in like the middle of a new council cycle. We're also in January, which is typically a low key month.
Yeah.
I mean, also that's because a lot of the budget stuff is at the back end of the year. So yeah. they typically take that month off as kind of a chance to recharge a bit. But yeah, it's been a busy several weeks at council for sure.
And I know the new councilors are staying busy trying to, you know, ask the questions and get caught up. And I know that, Counselor Geller missed a couple meetings because he has a newborn
child.
Man, it must be busy for them. Absolutely. Yeah.
He really planned that out well. he has a newborn at home. So, I mean, maybe the bright side for him is, you know, being up with a newborn gives him lots of time to read counsel materials. Yeah.
Shh, be quiet. I'm trying to read.
Or it's like maybe he puts the baby to sleep, you know.
Yeah.
Go reading on about CS, not 2019-87, Parkland Dedication Bylaw. We're in it, agreed.
It's good story time reading.
It's good story time reading.
Puts you right to sleep.
Oh, nearly. I get the impression, you know, maybe you can talk a bit about how people were feeling after the DC decision, which actually comes up for final passage next week.
Right.
But I gather from Parkland that there were a lot of people disappointed in. Although, like I pointed out in the thing I wrote for Guelph today, that it was more than staff was recommending. They bumped the thing to 30% cap instead of the 20% cap on high density outside of downtown.
Right.
But I think people still feel let down, that, or at least the people who desperately really care about Parkland still feel really let down.
And is that because they want more like intensification, or they want more sprawl? Like, what do they want to build in more, or they want to grow out more?
Well, in the case of Parkland people, I think it's that they feel like the city's not taking as much as they can from developers. I think in both cases, we have developers being not the bad guys per se, but, you know, the antagonists. There's not a lot of love for the developers, right? And again, that plays into people being concerned about the growth of the city and the sprawl. And that goes into the inordinate amount of influence that developers have, too.
I think there are some ways, just to analyze a bit, that city council or the public government can take the you know, the power of developers and the money of developers and turn it into things that are beneficial to the community. And to kind of go on a tangent for a bit, Dan Gibson wrote his first editorial or opinion piece for the Guelph Mercury. I don't know if you caught that.
I haven't read it yet.
It was cool because he talked about two ways of harnessing private developers to create beneficial public community spaces, and things that would create public spaces that have affordable housing and rent to own and all of that. So I think sometimes there are ways to curb that. Now with Parkland, I wouldn't really know too much about that, but I know that with the affordable housing, he offered a way to take the power of the you know, and maybe the whole Parkland dedication is supposed to do that, but it's not working, is what you're saying. So,
well, I don't know if it's not working yet. People think that. I think people have a feeling that developers are swindling council, and it's not unfair. You know, developers do have enormous influence, and when you look at how much money developers sink into particularly municipal elections.
Yeah.
It's not unsurprising. But if I could put the blame on the electorate for
it. Yeah.
It's hard to, you know, when you have voter turnout in local elections that's like at 33-34%, it's hard not to hear the one voice over the other, I think.
And right.
If you think that, you know, that local politics don't matter, well, I think here's an example, because if the people aren't going to talk, people who can make money by turning the situation to their advantage are definitely going to talk. And the other thing I will say is that, you know, the developers weren't necessarily happy with what was, you know, it wasn't a fait accompli is what I think, because the Developers Association came to both meetings, like a lot of people who are advocating for more Parkland came to both meetings. So there was a sense, I think, and maybe people who are disappointed in the decision can take some comfort in the fact that I think they had the developers sweating a bit, that it could have that it wasn't the cakewalk maybe that they hoped or maybe thought it would be.
And you know, I think that probably as council, they're probably thinking that, or at least many of them, that balance is the best thing.
And, sure.
And that you have to balance the intensification, building out, and parkland, and all of that, because there's more to parkland dedication than just the cash in lieu and the space. There's also the fact that you're building everything else in the city.
Right.
And that, you know, there's public lands and private lands and people with their own homes that want to do things to it. So I think that looking at it by itself is not always the best. That they council themselves are probably looking at it as a whole thing, puzzle pieces, right? And that, you know, people should definitely keep that in mind, that there's, you know, just to analyze a bit, that there, you know, there's a greater thing at play.
Right. I mean, there's a whole issue, I think, with holistic approaches to development, and not just in regards to parkland, not just in terms of the charges. But you see this where plans are put in the agenda for the planning committee, and it's like, we're going to build a 10-story apartment tower here, and then the neighborhood freaks, and you know, it becomes sort of a knife fight at the planning committee, at the statutory public meeting of the thing, and you know, and then it goes to, you know, months of sort of feedback and remediation and meetings with, you know, neighbors, and rather than just starting from the beginning and just saying like, hey neighbors, we're the developers of this plot of land here, and we're thinking about building X, what do you think? And just doing that work in advance so that there isn't a knife fight once you have all the plans drawn up and you deliver them to city staff.
You're right.
Because I mean, there's always a sense of NIMBYism. Like the unknown creates that, just the X factor of the unknown creates that. And so why not just mitigate that to begin with? And, you know, and this is part of something I'm trying to get at, is like, how are the developers working this? How is the city working this? How do neighborhoods work this? That's a big question.
And I think the communication thing you just touched on is important for things like Guelph Politico to come into play, to say, look, this is happening in your neighborhood during this, you know, boring council meeting. This is what happened.
Right.
This is important to you. Because even on just going back to the municipal election again, I know this, I bring this up all the time, but on the...
We know you ran.
We know, yeah. You all know by now. But one thing I encountered on the campaign trail was people would be living somewhere. They'd buy a house in a neighborhood. They'd expect that neighborhood to be a certain way. And suddenly a condo would pop up behind them. And no one told them anything. No developer came to see them. Their local counselor didn't come to see them. And, you know, so the case-by-case basis, going to people, whether you're the counselor or the developer or the city, whoever, talking to people is definitely something that at least some people believe should be improved on.
Yeah, like having some sort of packet, like some sort of... And this need not necessarily be the city's responsibility, because people... I would argue that people in their own neighborhoods maybe know their neighborhoods a bit better than maybe even their local ward counselor does.
Right.
That, you know, just putting something together and saying, hey, you're buying this house, you know, here's what's going to happen in, you know, 10 years, and here's, you know, what's happening in the neighborhood, and here, you know, there's a shopping area going up three blocks over there, so, you know, be a good time to buy or what have you.
Right.
Just, yeah, more communication. Yeah, so it's always good advice. Yeah.
Good talk.
So the other big, as we said, there was the other big meeting, standalone meeting of the month, was the final report for the Guelph Transit Business Service Review. I think a lot of us were surprised, or were not surprised, that there was nothing surprising in this service review. I think the big question is what happens next, because we've already kind of seen what happens next, because we had Councillor Phil Ault taking the transit challenge and admitting failure. So, you know, were you surprised by the result? No, you're shaking your head. No,
absolutely. the transit review was always going to be the problem package.
Yeah,
and the city council had to turn that into the solutions package.
Right.
Which is something I said since October. So That was how it was, and it's funny because some candidates, including ones that are currently on council, touted the transit review as the sort of godsend, these are all the solutions type thing.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily what it was about. Although they did pass all 12 recommendations that will be rolled out over the next 3 to 5 years. And I guess the first big thing up is the 19 new drivers that they need. Which will cost $260,000 for 2019 when that's passed, I believe, March or April, or February, sorry, February, April, or February or March. Oh, man.
Right. No, March 5th is the budget meeting.
March 5th, yeah.
So I think it's 19 drivers, but I think it's to be phased in over 6 years.
Oh, 6 years, okay.
So it's like $280,000 per year.
Right.
Yeah, that's the other big piece of that that's coming up in the budget is more money for, I think it's 6 more buses to add to the fleet, particularly for expanding the community bus, although there's kind of no set plan about what that's going to look like yet, but because they have to put the order in and it has to be, if they're going to expand the community bus by 2020, then they have to get the buses, they'll put the order in now.
Right.
So yeah, I like that. It was the problem package.
Yeah.
I'm glad. One of the things I'm glad of is that they put a number on it, and they said we need 19 more drivers.
Yeah.
Because I think this is. It's been the worst kept secret for a while that there aren't enough drivers to cover the system, as it stands right now. And this has been a problem that goes way back because I remember. 2011, 2010, actually maybe not that far back, but 2011, 2012, when we recorded Gang of Four on Sunday morning, I think the show was on Monday morning, I would get up, go to the first bus of the morning on a Sunday morning, which was the when it leaves downtown at 9:15, and, you know, it was 10-1 in Pick'em if it would show up. And there were more than a few times, and this even goes back to like a couple of summers ago. I had to go to work first thing on Sunday morning, and the bus didn't come. And it's just this systemic problem that there are times, and you can set your watch to it almost, there just aren't enough drivers.
Yeah.
And it took a while for transit, I think, to fess up to this fact that, we just don't have the people. Which is, and I think this point was made at the meeting, it's weird that I guess the local economy is so competitive that we can't hire drivers to work good paying union jobs driving a bus around all day.
Yeah.
And and this is where a piece that I think the service review is missing was it can't just be that Guelph's economy is so good. What are we missing that's keeping us from being able to put drivers in driver's seats?
Yeah.
I don't know what that is, but I think that's a piece that's missing from this discussion.
That's a good, and I wonder if part of the transit review, if there was a talk about competitive wages compared to, you know, TTC, My Way, like, I'm sure if you're someone who gets a degree, you probably get a college degree, diploma to drive a bus or whatever you do.
I don't know what the specifications are, but
once you reach those,
but you do have to be trained to drive a bus. It's a specialized license,
right? Yeah, and it takes some skill. So you know, when you're sitting there, you're ready. You have your specifications, and you're going for a job. Like, how does Guelph stay competitive? Like, what's the incentives maybe? Are there maybe incentives they need to offer, like better benefits? I don't really know what drivers get currently, but I met a few, and they seem happy to be driving and be part of the union there and everything. But, you know, yeah, that's a really good angle on that. I never thought about that. But, like, what makes Guelph attractive to them instead of going to TTC or somewhere else?
And that was the other piece of it, because one of the counselors asked, like, can we bring in, like, people who, you know, like commuters, people who don't live in Guelph, but, you know, people who live in other areas. And the response there was, like, well, we go to the trouble of training them. The training isn't, like, Guelph-specific. they're driving Guelph Transit buses. So if a job opportunity comes up, and let's say they live in Cambridge or London or Brampton, and a job comes up to drive for Brampton Transit or Grand River Transit or London Transit, what have you,
yeah,
they're going to take that opportunity because a bus is a bus is a bus.
And it's right there instead of another city away. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Huh.
So there's more to it than just like putting out the help wanted sign. And I would like to know what that is. I would also like to know what that is because if I'm not mistaken, hiring is also an issue with other transit systems too. I think Grand River Transit has talked about its issues in trying to hire people. So it isn't just a matter of a good economy, a boom economy. I that just feels not right. And I don't know whether it's like,
yeah,
Guelph is like, you know, we demand the best of the best of the best.
Yeah, what is our, well,
because I think, you know, nobody really has a complaint about drivers, I don't think, but, you know.
Not themselves,
many.
No.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to see, like, just an open and out complaint about the shoddy customer service of one of the drivers. Because I don't think the people is the problem. But there's something.
And I wonder, maybe there will now have to be a Guelph Politico investigative story.
Thanks for adding to my workload.
I'll help. No worries. Well, just that's an interesting angle. Like, can we compare, like, can we make a chart of the five nearest transit systems, what benefits they get, how much they're paid, compare that to Guelph? I mean, maybe we'll see an answer pretty clearly there.
Like, could be.
If drivers in another city are making significantly more money or get significantly better benefits and they're not having issues with hiring drivers, then that's probably one of the answers, at least.
It could be, and the other factor could be, you know, a lot of it is expected too, because, you know, for when the hiring falls short, it does fall on the other drivers just to pick up the slack, and that's where all the overtime costs come in, right?
Yeah.
So it's tricky. I find it interesting that, because I want to talk about the Phil thing.
Yeah.
He tried. Kudos to for trying. And I will, a lot of people dumped on him for like, oh, you failed and you gave up. And it's like, well, you know what? When I understand. Sometimes you have to concede defeat. And if you're in an important position like city councilor and you have to be at places at certain times and, you know, maybe you have to give up the ghost a little. But I think the lesson in the quote-unquote failure is that if you work a job like a city councilor, transit can't have your back.
Which
it can't
is
be
not
your
good.
Your method. Yeah. Which is not good.
Yeah.
Right.
You think that the public service that they fund would be able to get them to work, and it's ironic that,
right?
You know, that doesn't. And I will say, I was, scrolling through one of the Facebook groups, and someone made the point that why didn't other councillors try this? And Dominique O'Rourke responded to them, ever the good communicator, and said,
she's good.
she said, I have two kids who go to sports and things like that. I teach in Cambridge and I'm working in Guelph as a counselor and otherwise.
Right.
And she said there would be no way she could do it, which, you know, that's true.
talk about getting to Cambridge on public transit. Because I went to a poverty symposium not last year, the year before that, and I took public transit. You'd get the Greyhound to the Ainslie Street Terminal, not the Ainslie Street Terminal, the one that's down the Sports World Drive Terminal. And then you get Grand River Transit, and that's almost like a full half-hour route to get you into, like, downtown Cambridge. It's so, you know, you're talking about either a 20-minute drive or, you know, once you kind of factor in riding Guelph Transit to get to Guelph Central Station, you're talking about, like, you know, 70, 80 minutes. It's not practical, but, I mean, I think that's another reason why a noble failure as what Phil Ault did teaches us more than if he had succeeded, like if he was like doing parkour or whatever to get to different routes or something. It shows you just how difficult it is for people in certain fields and in doing certain activities to get to where they're going. at the same time, what I don't want to lose sight of is the fact that there are people who don't have choice, that there are people who work and have kids and activities, and for whom the car is, having a car is not affordable.
Yeah.
And they do have to take the bus. So that piece of it is tricky too.
Yeah.
That there are two sides of this. Yes, if you're lucky enough to be able to take a car, you can do that. But there are a lot of people in the city who are not lucky. And you have to walk a very thin line to say that, you know what, if you're lucky enough to be able to own your own car and being able to drive, you can ditch transit. But for if you can't, well, whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the message Phil. I don't think it's the message Phil wanted to put out either.
No.
But that's, you have to be careful because that's the message sometimes people take away.
There you go. You summed it up. I think that's good. Yeah, good. Just with council, you know.
But I think the message came out of it was real, and I think that's also why it got picked up on the CBC wire, why it went national, because it speaks to the very real problems.
Absolutely. It was deserving of going national. Like, that was something that probably other people feel in other cities too, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Maybe that'll challenge other councilors to try it in other cities. But you know, I think transit's one of those problems that we'll have eternally until I'm dead. So, like, even Toronto has it, right?
Yeah, yeah, but, yeah.
Although they have buses that come every 10 minutes and run on Sundays, so that's nice.
Yeah, I mean, that was... there's going to be further reviews of the service in terms of routes and schedules, so I hope that's one of the things that comes back with this, is longer service on sort of weekend nights, like maybe going to one or two, longer service on Sundays, like maybe at least going to like 8 or 9.
Yeah.
Or starting earlier even. Because there are a lot of places that open early on a Sunday, and so, you know, you're cutting a lot of people, and I mean like stores and things, things that, you know, people are naturally inclined to take transit in order to get to those jobs because they're minimum wage jobs. So it's there's more work to do for sure.
Absolutely.
Yes, the other topic we're gonna do.
Yeah.
we had here on campus, we're recording at CFRU. Will it be here this time next year? Stay tuned.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. But, you know, there's the issues right now about tuition and student fees. You're in the unique position of not just being a journalist, but also being a student. So, you know, what's the feeling among your fellow students? You don't go to the U of G here. You go to U of G Humber. But, you know, but they will also be affected by this.
Oh, yeah.
So what are the folks saying? What are the folks saying?
Well, good question. No, there's definitely a loud, maybe majority. There's a loud group of people that are obviously against it. You know, yesterday you were covering the Guelph rally, but in Toronto we had, I think the number was around 2,000 is the number that I saw floating. Could have been more, could have been less, but thousands of students yesterday marched on Queen's Park in Toronto. Students from a bunch of different schools, and, you know, they were saying we don't like the OSAP cuts to the grants and also the optional student fees. So I'm also in the unique position of being one of the editors at my school's publication at Guelph Humber, the Avro Post, and, you know, it's been interesting as a campus publication to try and stay impartial, but a lot of campus publications are worried because they could be defunded. Mm-hmm. And you were just saying CFRU, one of those, because there's the tuition cuts, but there's also these optional student fees where students will be able to, you know, check on a list. Now, we don't know what it's going to look like exactly yet, but, you know, they'll be able to defund things or not put their money towards certain things, such as campus newspapers, parts of student unions, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. It's funny you should mention it from the journalistic side, that you're trying to cover it from a publication that these changes may result in it not being able to function at the same levels, or perhaps even result in not being able to function at all. It's almost that, you know, you can't be impartial. you know, because you're the existence is at stake. So it's funny to walk this fine line. It's one of the reasons I've sort of struggled to, in terms of like writing about this and covering this, which is why an episode of the Politicast coming up is going to be with one of the main organizers of Students for Ontario, because it's sort of hard for me to put distance, because I'm a volunteer here at CFRU. I was a volunteer and a staff member of the Ontarian. That's where I learned the trade, as it were. So I was involved in groups here on campus. So, you know, you feel very close to this.
Yeah.
And you can't bring that level of impartiality, because the visceral reaction is like, leave it alone. Leave it alone, Doug Ford. Leave it alone.
Absolutely. And I think some publications have done a good job. The Varsity, which is, you know, state-of-the-art, top student newspaper in Canada.
The U of T newspaper.
Yeah, U of T. And they've had some opinion pieces. They produced three of them, and two of them were kind of anti it. But one was in favor of the optional student fees. And I will say, just a bit of analysis, is that our particular student union at Humber College North Campus, which also represents Guelph Humber students, it's a complicated situation, but they do, and kind of Humber College's CSA, and they, you know, they've haven't been very clear in the past with like budgets, things like that, bad communication. So I'm curious whether for some student unions or for some students, the optional student fees is a good thing. Mm. Because now, for once, student governments might now be accountable. They've been in a solid place so far. They, you know, they're almost untouchable in a lot of ways. You can't FOI them because they're not public domains in that same way.
Right.
So now they may be more accountable to students. And for us, that's good, actually, because now we can hold them accountable.
It's an interesting perspective. There was also certainly the report that the Eye Opener had about the student government at Ryerson being a little loose with the company credit card, shall we say. But of course, I mean, that stuff leaves student groups, all student groups, open to attacks. And certainly Doug Ford has used the student journalism of the Eye Opener to justify the direction this is, that, you know, they're wasting the taxpayers' students' money or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that is one way to look at it, too, that if, you know, student organizations maybe have to work harder to prove, you know, that they're spending the money efficiently and wisely, as I think most student groups are. I think that's an interesting part of it too.
I just don't think it could be the worst thing necessarily.
Sure.
Because as you know, with anything that is capitalistic or whatever, you know things will be refined and things will get better when you are forced to. When you are forced to do the best job that you can, and that's why student elections this year are critical across.
Yes.
Ontario right now, like these representatives that you elect right now are the ones that are going to be heading into this turbulence. And you know, I'm sure we could be talking 8 years from now and it'll be restored and maybe the optional student fees will be gone, but maybe it'll stay because people will say this is a great idea. But I think most of the opposition definitely comes with the Ontario student assistance program cuts.
Right. The other thing I'll say about the student fees is that I think, and I could be corrected if I'm wrong, but I think this is right, is that it's always been optional. It's that you could come to CFRU as a student. It's like, I do not want my $7 or $8 or whatever to go to CFRU. And you can come and you can make that petition. I think what the difference is that it's depending on how the system is set up, it could be as easy as a click. As you go to go to your website as an incoming student or as a returning student, and just say, "Click here to unclick all the fees." And if you make it that easy, how many people are just going to do it because it would put an extra $500 in their pocket?
They'll see $500. I'm not going to click that. And
right,
I think that we'll have to see, because so the Avropost had the chance to interview the parliamentary secretary for skills, training, and education. So one of the higher ups in that ministry. And he was telling us that he doesn't really know how it'll be laid out, but
right.
It'll mostly be left to the schools.
Interesting.
So maybe the student union will have to be petitioning the school administrations now to say, look, we want it laid out this way, which is interesting because then the Ontario government would be putting the power of how the student union is funded into the administrations of the schools, which is a weird power dynamic. Because then they can hold that over the student unions. But we're going to have to see how that all plays out in August.
Right. I mean, that's one of the most bizarre parts of this is that and it's not just with the student fees and with changes to OSTAP, but this government seems to enjoy making these grand pronouncements and really doesn't have any idea of what the follow-through is going to be. And even the Board of Governors here and the President's office, Dr. Vaccarino, has no idea what the end effect of the 10% tuition cut is going to be or what that's going to look like or where they're going to find the funding or what it's going to look like come September, which is when these changes are supposed to go into effect. And so if the government has no idea, how is the university supposed to have any idea?
And another, I think, small underreported segment of this, very underreported, because, of course, I'm finding a lot of the campus newspapers are quite, they're not really impartial in all the reporting, very much rah, 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 Ford's doing this to your education. But there's some, so what they're doing with the international students is that 10% tuition cut is not going to apply to them. Right. And I was reporting on the York strike almost a year ago now. And one of the issues with students there is they said York University was trying to bring in more international students because they make more money off them, almost three times as much. Now, this may force universities to bring in more domestic students, which is technically, like objectively saying, better for Canadians because they'll have higher rates of getting into the school because they'll want to fill it with more, there'll be less international students coming over. So that could be a benefit too, depending. Playing devil's advocate here, of course.
No,
or and other side of it.
To further the devil's advocate piece of that, though, is that anyone who can afford, I think, to come to university probably already does. And so you're bringing in more students who would probably have to take out more loans. And, of course, with grants gone, it means more debt loads that they're carrying. I mean, it's just I think it's important to look at all sides of this. But it's an incredibly complicated situation.
And it's so crazy how close we came to this going the opposite way. If the NDP were voted in, we would have had loan forgiveness.
Yeah.
So no more debts for anybody at all. My mother, who's still paying off student debts from this University of Guelph, wouldn't have to do that anymore. I think she is.
I'm like $500 away from paying off my student loan. So if there was loan forgiveness, I'd be pretty pissed.
Yeah, I guess so, eh? Maybe you can get a 10% cut now. I don't know.
Oh, jeez. You know what? When I first came here, my first semester, the first semester of tuition was under $2,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like 19-something, but it was under $2,000, and it has just gone up and up and up in 20 years. Right, I mean, and that's the other part of this, too, is that, you know, We do have funding issues that, you know, it has been on the backs of the students for a long, long time. And I mean, and that's the double entendre of this, that a 10% tuition cut sounds good, but there is no 10% additional funding on the other side of that. So it means a $360 million hole for universities and an $80 million hole for colleges. And I think that's another piece that's underreported is how
the
institutions are going to fill that hole.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a downer to leave it on, but we'll leave it there.
Go vote.
Go vote. Vote in your student elections. That's a good. That's a good message to vote on.
There you go.
All right. Thanks, Eli.
Yeah. Thank you.
And once again, that was Eli Ritter. You can catch up on all these topics by visiting our coverage at GuelphPolitico.ca, and you can surely stay tuned for more coverage on the post-secondary funding issues in the weeks to come. Look for another Guelph Stuff segment to hit the podcast feed sometime next month. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host of the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph by considering a donation to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how you can do that at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.